Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to the On Poly podcast. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
The Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms has been in place for nearly four decades, and never in that time has the province of Ontario used a clause in that charter to override a court decision. Never. Until now. It's a big deal, and we'll tell you why. Also, we've had our friend John Wright from Maru Public Opinion do some polling exclusively for this podcast, and it reveals some fascinating developments on the state of the current Ontario government's popularity. It's Tuesday, June 15th, 2021, so let's get to it. JMM, our country repatriated its constitution with an accompanying Charter of Rights and Freedoms in 1982. And ever since then, no provincial government in Ontario has seen fit to use a clause that's in that charter to override a court decision. That streak is now over. The Ford government has used the notwithstanding clause of the charter to set aside a court decision that would have struck down an election expenses law that this government passed. Now, this is perfectly legal for Ford to have done this. But as we say, it's also unprecedented. And as we sit here recording this on a Monday afternoon, why don't you update us? What's happening in the Ontario legislature over the weekend?
MPPs were called back for a special sitting. It's a rare event on two counts. First, they are sitting outside the usual political calendar at Queen's Park. And secondly, because they sat over the weekend, including a late into the evening sitting on Saturday. You know, people might wonder why the government would bother to do this. They have a majority in the legislature and they can, you know, in the final accounting, there's never really any mystery how this vote is going to turn out. And the answer is basically the legislature's standing orders, the rules that govern debate at Queen's Park. Basically, the government just needs to burn through a certain amount of time on debate before they can force it through the next stage. So that's what they did over the weekend. They went through debate time to pass a scheduling motion, basically forcing the bill to get passed on a certain timetable. And certainly by the time this episode reaches our listeners' ears, it will have already passed third reading and received royal assent. It passed second reading just before we entered our respective recording spaces.
And just so we're clear, they did sit all night long, right? Overnight?
Yes. There is the power of the government to basically force MPPs to sit for debate overnight. And, you know, we saw them do this with the bill to cut Toronto City Council in half back at the beginning of Ford's tenure. Also, an occasion where the Ford government threatened to use the notwithstanding clause, but ended up not needing to because a court decision that they had lost was reversed on appeal.
So when the government uses the notwithstanding clause to set aside a court's decision, which is the case here, and then recrafts new rules for election advertising, let's figure out what the new rules are going to be. What does that landscape look like once the new bill is in place and the law is in effect?
The big change in the law, and the one that was nullified by a court last week, is a restriction on what third parties can do and say prior to an election. So in 2016, the Liberal government under Kathleen Wynne, you may recall they were catching a lot of political heat because at the time, Ontario's campaign finance rules were a bit of a wild west. They were certainly a lot looser than the federal rules are. And in the midst of a bit of let's say, political scandal, the Liberals brought in a much tougher campaign finance regime, and it included a rule saying that third parties, that is, anybody who's not a registered political party, they have to restrict their spending in the 6 months before an election was called. Earlier this year, in 2021, the Ford government actually extended that restriction from 6 months to 12 months. And that extension in particular was what Justice Edward Morgan found was too much of a breach for the Charter's guarantee of free expression. But that court decision is going to be short-lived because the use of the notwithstanding clause this week will effectively reverse Justice Morgan's decision and will reimpose or reinstate that 12-month limit. And of course, We are less than 12 months away from an election, so it is going to effectively be, you know, immediately applicable. Anybody who is not a registered political party in Ontario is going to be subject to these third-party spending rules.
And again, let's understand why this is a big deal for so many groups. We're thinking of teachers, we're thinking of nurses, we're thinking of Ontario Proud, for example. There are all sorts of third parties that are not going to be caught by this new limit. And why it's a big deal is, if you have a finite amount of money that you're allowed to spend, and you can spend it in a 6-month period of time, well, that's a bigger bang for your buck than if you can spend it over a 12-month period of time. Now you've got the same amount of money, but it's over a 12-month period in which you can spend it. So presumably, these groups feel their free speech rights are being infringed upon as a result. Have I got that right?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's worth saying that the dollar figure involved here is not a huge amount of money. It was $600,000 was the limit that the Liberals brought in, or about $100,000 for each of the 6 months that the spending cap applied to. And what the Progressive Conservative government did was take the same dollar figure and just extend it for twice as long. So effectively, you went from being able to spend, you know, about $100,000 a month to being able to spend $50,000 a month. And especially in like the GTA media market, $50,000 does not buy you a lot. I've certainly spoken to political operatives who say like these spending limits are so tight that effectively they would have to hold their fire until very nearly the last month before an election, or they just couldn't afford to do anything.
All right. So we will obviously continue to watch this story. It's an historic story. We have never seen the notwithstanding clause used in the province of Ontario before. Yes, in Quebec many times. I think maybe once in Saskatchewan. But as for Ontario, this is new. So we'll have to see how this one rolls out. Now, let's get to some of the polling that our friend John Wright from Maru Public Opinion did exclusively for this podcast, and we want to thank John very much for that. We asked a bunch of different questions, so we're going to roll them out now. And Maru was in the field a week ago. They surveyed more than 1,100 people, John Michael, and that's considered a good sample size when you're doing this kind of polling. Now, first, on the issue of shutting down the school year and not bringing back in-class learning, the public seems to agree with that call. 69% of Ontarians surveyed agree with Doug Ford's position that the schools should be out for the rest of the year, no more in-class learning. Only 31% disagree. Now, when you're on side with almost 7 out of 10 Ontarians, politically, JMM, that's a pretty good place to be.
Yeah, I wouldn't have predicted this one if you'd asked me before we did the poll. You know, there has been such anger around the issue of schools reopening or not online and in social media. And I think I would have predicted a more even split. I'm not sure that... this was a bit of a surprise to me. Seems like a winner for the government. You know, as you say, 7 of 10 Ontarians are basically okay with it. And, you know, that's not a bad place to be as we go over the summer. I think one sort of point of caution, I guess I would say, is we'll see what school reopening looks like in September. You know, I don't think the government can rest on its laurels on this particular point.
I was just going to say that. I was going to say that the government should not infer, therefore, that people don't want the schools back open in September. Because, listen, I have no polling on this, but I bet they do.
Yes.
I'll just say that. Okay, let's keep going here. Let's look at the provincial reopening, which we're in the midst of stage one right now. 52% of those surveyed approve with the government's reopening and move into stage one. 48% disapprove of the job that the government is doing. That's a pretty even split, 52-48.
Yeah, this is almost the opposite of the last question. I would have actually predicted a much more substantial split one way or the other. It seems like something that people would have strong feelings about, but this almost makes me wonder whether people are like flipping a coin before they answer the poll. you know, again, not a terrible result for the government, you know, but this one obviously a bit more mixed.
How well do people think the premier is managing the pandemic? The marks are not quite so good. 46% approve of the job Doug Ford and his government are doing managing the pandemic. 54% disapprove. 46-54. Your reaction to that?
I guess the thing that this makes me think about is how, really from the beginning of his provincial political career, at least from the beginning of 2018 when Doug Ford entered the PC leadership race, there's been a pretty consistent theme that, you know, his personal brand tends to pull behind that of the PC party generally. Obviously, there have been some exceptions to that over the last few years, but there were certainly people in 2018 who, you know, did not love Doug Ford, but were sick and tired of the Liberals, and so they sort of held their nose and voted for the Tories. And part of me wonders if we might be seeing a bit of a return to normalcy in Ontario politics, you know, people not exactly giving their wholehearted endorsement to Doug Ford, but not hating the job the government is doing either.
Well, let's ask the direct question here then. As to the Premier's overall job rating, how well do you think Premier Doug Ford is doing at his job of being Premier of Ontario? 48% approve, 52% disapprove. So again, a fairly even split, but those numbers, they don't really tell the whole story here, do they?
No, and, you know, again, context and history matter. Just last year in the aftermath of the first wave of COVID-19, you know, he was in the mid-60s. He had halo around him to a certain extent, lots of approval, and, you know, lots of other premiers in the country benefited from their response to the first waves. And Doug Ford, in this case, has fallen a lot from those highs. He, you know, was in the mid-60s, obviously now below 50%. He is still well above where he was in early 2020. If we cast our memories back to the pre-COVID time of, you know, let's say January of 2020, he was very, very unpopular. They'd had that really disastrous year of 2019 with an incredibly unpopular budget. And then, I think certainly it's sort of the received wisdom that Doug Ford's personal unpopularity helped cost Andrew Scheer the federal election in the fall of 2019. So they are lower than they were at their best, but they're also higher in approval than they were at their worst. So I guess, you know, at the moment, all you can really say is we've got some sense of what his ceiling and floor are as far as approval ratings go.
Right. Now, interestingly enough, we not only asked about Doug Ford's approval rating, we also wanted to know about Dr. David Williams, the just departed former medical officer of health for the province of Ontario. And it may surprise those listening to hear that David Williams has a 58% job approval rating. That is 10 points higher than the Premier's. Are you one of those, John Michael, who's surprised to see that number?
I was surprised. Maybe that just reflects on the extent to which I was in a reporter's bubble, something I think a lot of us in media struggle against. And I had sort of assumed that if you knew who Dr. Williams was at all, you might have a more critical take on his job performance over the last year. Certainly you and I have talked about, I think in particular, his communication style and how he is not always the clearest communicator at a time when clear communications are really valuable. But it looks like he leaves office with much of the province wishing him well, if nothing else.
Indeed. All right. Now we thought we would ask a kind of an offbeat, I hope, interesting question here. It's a bit of a what-if question. We asked people, if you could choose any of the three major parties at Queen's Park to have been in power over the past 15 months and have been in charge of managing this pandemic, who would you have chosen? Okay? It's not who would you vote for if the election were held today. It's who, if you had the choice, would you like to have seen in charge of managing the pandemic over the last 15 months? And interestingly enough, the biggest chunk of people, 42%, opted for the current Progressive Conservatives. Only 25% would have preferred the NDP, the New Democratic Party, to have been in power. Only 24% would have approved of the Liberals. And actually, we got the Greens in there as well. 9% would have rather seen Mike Schreiner with his hand on the tiller over the last little while. What do you infer from those numbers?
Well, I mean, I love the idea of the sort of alternative history, speculative fiction in which Mike Schreiner was premier during the pandemic. I think that would have been fascinating. I think these numbers, it's true that we didn't ask for voter intention, but I think you could say these sort of fairly reflect voter intention. If people weren't directly thinking about the next election, this looks a lot like what the next election could look like, right? If these numbers were voter intention, you know, at 42%, you would expect the progressive conservatives to have another majority government. That question of the progressive vote splitting between the New Democrats and the Liberals. We've discussed this before. You know, it's an interesting part of what's going on in Ontario politics right now, and it's worth watching to see whether people continue to split the vote between the second and third party, or whether, you know, it wouldn't take many votes, frankly, from either the Liberals or the NDP to switch parties before things would look a lot more competitive and potentially put the progressive conservatives in some real jeopardy in the next election.
Yeah, if you're a member of the PC party right now or you're one of their partisan supporters, you got to love what those numbers say. Because
yeah.
Those numbers say Doug Ford's on his way to a second majority government and his opponents are quite evenly split, that's the way Tories stay in power. You split the center-left vote between the Liberals and New Democrats, and the more you can split that vote 50-50, the better off you're doing. Now, we got one more question in here, and again, this one's we had a little fun with this one here. We wanted some sense of whether or not people knew who the leader of the Ontario Liberals is. Now, you ask, why did we only ask about the Liberals? Well, I'll tell you why. Doug Ford's been in the public spotlight for a decade, right? He was on Toronto City Council before. He's now the premier. His name recognition, I don't think, is much of an issue. Andrea Horvath, the opposition leader, is about to lead her party into a fourth general election. She has been around for a long time. Mike Schreiner of the Greens has been around for a decade as well as the leader of that party. The leader of the Liberals only won that job 15 months ago. So, do people know who he is? And rather than just cold call people here, we offered them five options. Okay? Who's the leader of the Ontario Liberals, we asked? Is it Kathleen Wynne, Manuel D'Souza, John Fraser, Stephen Del Duca, or none of the above? Now, John Michael? Okay, here's my survey of one. Do you know the correct answer, John Michael?
Yes, it's Stephen Del Duca.
Congratulations. Okay, you are in the majority. And the good news for Stephen Del Duca is 69% of those surveyed picked his name as the leader of the Liberal Party. 7 out of 10. That's not bad. The bad news is 23% said none of the above. So there's still a quarter of Ontarians surveyed who really had no idea that he's the guy. So I guess he's still got a bit of a job to improve his profile.
Yeah, and we've discussed this before. It's legitimately a hard thing to do when you are the leader of a very diminished third party, no official status at the legislature. He himself does not have a seat. He has, you know, because of the pandemic, has also, you know, not really been able to go out in public. He was actually at the legislature on Monday. He went to speak there in person. He's otherwise been doing a lot of press conferences over Zoom lately. So I think you could say the good news is that he's got room to grow, I guess. But the clock is ticking, and obviously something that the Liberal Party is going to work at hard over the summer and fall.
Interestingly enough, 5% of those surveyed thought Kathleen Wynne was still the Liberal Party leader, which may be wishful thinking among her supporters, or who knows, maybe they just haven't watched the news much in a long while. But she's still a member of the Ontario Legislature, of course. She's still a member for Don Valley West, but she's not the leader of the Liberal Party anymore.
No, and not running again in the next election. And I know it's just 5% and one shouldn't be terribly dramatic about these kinds of things, but that's one of those results that makes me question why I do this all day, every day.
No. If the number were 50%, then you could question.
Okay.
5%, you're right. That's still half as many people as think Elvis is still alive, so I think that's a reasonable number.
Okay. You make me feel better.
Okay, let's return to the election spending story that we discussed earlier, JMM.
So there are really two parts to this story. The first being what is in the law that the court said was unconstitutional, and the second being the use of the notwithstanding clause. We tackle both of these issues with Paul Cavalluzzo of Cavalluzzo LLP. He is the lawyer for Working Families, the group that opposes both the government's new law and the use of the notwithstanding clause. Here's Steve's conversation with him.
Paul, let's start with this. What did the court say was unconstitutional about the election expenses law that was struck down?
Well, the court said that the 12-month period in which the third parties would be regulated was too long in terms of the charter protection of freedom of expression, and found that there was absolutely no evidence that 12 months was needed because the previous regulated period of 6 months was found to have been adequate and, in fact, effective. And as a result of that, the court said that 12 months was far too long, and indeed far longer than any other jurisdiction in Canada.
Well, this, of course, raises the obvious question. 6 months is okay. 12 months is too long. How do you know where to draw the line?
Well, I guess one thing you can do is to determine whether 6 months worked. And the evidence before Justice Morgan was from the government's own witnesses, expert witnesses, was that 6 months was effective and did the trick. So that was clearly conclusive, and there was no need to go longer than 12 months. And what Justice Morgan said is that when you're violating charter rights, you've got to do it in a minimal way. And if you can do it in 6 months, that's what you should do rather than 12 months.
Well, as you well know, we violate rights in this country all the time, and we have the constitutional right to do so, I guess. Is it your view there should be no restrictions whatsoever?
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the restrictions which do infringe upon political speech, which is really the core value underlying Section 2, has to be tailored very, very carefully to ensure that even though the speech may be regulated, it's done in such a careful way that the speech is not defeated. And that's what was clearly not done in this case, because once again, the evidence was 6 months did the trick. Why did you have to go to 12 months with no study or report, indeed, by a complete surprise?
You know the government's position on this, of course, is that there are far too many, in its judgment, too many outside so-called special interest groups that are perverting democracy by inundating the airwaves and social media with attack ads. And I guess they're concerned that most of those attack ads are going to be aimed at them. Is that a legitimate concern?
Well, certainly passing legislation in order to deal with what view to be your political enemies is not a legitimate concern. But dealing more with the their alleged concern, it's really nonsense, because if you look at what happened between the 2014 election and 2018 election, which they never refer to, the third party spending in the 2018 election was half of what it was in 2014. And indeed, in 2014, third-party spending was 72% of what the political parties spent. And by 2018, with the Wynn Law, that's the Premier Wynn Law, it was down to 10%. So that's why the government witnesses said that the six-month limit was effective. And there was absolutely no need to go to 12 months, because all the indicators were that the 6 months worked. And the suggestion is, since it worked, one asks, well, why would the government introduce 12 months? And I think you answered the question, because they're targeting what they view to be their political enemies.
Well, I mean, to be sure that there are unions, there are others who will want to spend money advertising to get their point of view across during an election period and before. But there are also, you know, things like Canada Proud, Ontario Proud. There are groups on the other side of the political spectrum that would also want to wade into this space and advertise as well. When you weigh it all, one versus the other, does one dominate more than the other in your view?
Yes, because trade unions, for the most part, dominate third-party spending and have done historically, particularly since 2003, when Working Families was created in order to deal with the common sense revolution. Yes, there are parties on the other, third parties on the other side, like Proud Ontario, but the bulk of the third party spending are trade unions, and that's the concern of the government.
So there's no question in your mind this will disproportionately affect your clients, and that it is not sort of an even brushstroke as you look at this new law.
That's correct, particularly in light of the fact that the trade unions don't really have a lot of access to mainstream media. The government has unlimited advertising. The political parties are only regulated for 6 months, not 12 months. There's all kinds of indicators that suggest that this was a draconian law aimed at my client.
I do have to say, I see union leaders on television and on the radio, and of course on the program I do all the time. Do you really think they can't get the word out?
Well, they fortunately, TVO is a very fair station and listens to all sides of the any kind of public policy issue. But certainly when you're looking at, for example, in Toronto, you've got four newspapers. Three of them would abolish trade unions if they could. So that I think that, you know, there are certain exceptions. The Toronto Star periodically is somewhat sympathetic, and other outlets like TVO and CBC are fair in terms of listening to interests other than corporate interests. And, of course, that's our concern.
Okay, that's the story on the particulars of the bill. Let's now go to the other story here, which is, of course, the first ever use of the notwithstanding clause by the government of Ontario to set aside a court decision. Let's do a little Charter of Rights and Freedoms 101 here for those who don't know. The notwithstanding clause of the Charter is essentially what?
What the Section 33 or the notwithstanding clause says that the government can pass a declaration saying that the law will be operative and apply notwithstanding anything in the Charter. And that's what happened in this case, is they passed the old law basically saying, regardless of what Justice Ed Morgan said about Section 2B of the Charter, this law is going to apply regardless.
So basically, it's giving governments the right to set aside constitutionally enumerated rights that citizens have because the government of the day is prepared, if there is a political price to be paid, to pay that price. Fair to say?
That's correct. And it's, as you know, it's for a 5-year limit. In other words, within 5 years, they would have to reintroduce the declaration if they want the declaration to continue.
Now, admittedly, this is the first time that the province of Ontario in nearly four decades will use the notwithstanding clause. However, I am hearing, obviously, supporters of this government say the clause is in the Charter, so presumably it's there to be used, no?
Well, you know, it has a very interesting history, and the history, you may recall, Steve, back in 1982, was that Prime Minister Trudeau was very, very firmly in favor of an entrenched Charter of Rights or Bill of Rights, and he couldn't completely sell that because the Western premiers, particularly Alan Blakeney of Saskatchewan, was very concerned about the courts overruling legislation made by the legislature. And as a result of that, a historic compromise was made, and that was the notwithstanding clause, so that Trudeau got his Charter of Rights, but there was a notwithstanding clause in respect to certain freedoms in the Charter. That was the compromise, but as many people have said, it was intended to be used very sparingly as a last resort, because what you're doing with the notwithstanding clause is you're overriding charter rights, and the Charter of Rights, as you know, is very, very popular with Canadians. So you're right, there could be a political price to pay, and if they're prepared to pay it, then you know, they take the gamble.
There's something deeply ironic about this, in as much as we have the notwithstanding clause in part because an NDP premier, Alan Blakeney of Saskatchewan, was afraid that union rights would be trampled if they didn't have this so-called, you know, safety valve in the Constitution. And now the safety valve is being used to, in your view, deprive union members of their rights. That's kind of weird, isn't it?
It is a historical irony, but as I said, that was the historic compromise. Certainly, Pierre Trudeau did not want a notwithstanding clause, and he was finally satiated because he said, okay, you can have a notwithstanding clause so long as it doesn't override language rights. And that's how the deal was done. But you're right, it was Alan Blakeney, for the most part, that stood firm in respect of demanding the notwithstanding clause.
Now, people are looking around asking, you know, the notwithstanding clause is kind of the nuclear option in this case. Were there other alternatives the Ford government could have employed that might not have been, you know, DEFCON 1, if you like?
Absolutely. And that's the concern that I have as a constitutional lawyer, because Justice Morgan came up with a pretty quick decision. And the reason he came up with a pretty quick decision, he gave the government an opportunity to reintroduce legislation which would be compliant with the Charter. And rather than doing that, the day after he pronounced his decision, they said, well, we're going to use the notwithstanding clause. So they didn't even attempt to come up with with legislation which was compliant with the charter. And of course, the other thing they could have done, as they did in the City of Toronto case, they could have moved for an appeal and in the interim moved for a stay of the judgment, which they didn't do in this case. So in any event, in my view, disrespectful of the charter, disrespectful of the court, and a very unfortunate turn of events, because as you know, once you use something, you tend to become addicted to it and you keep using it. And that's going to be a very, very grave situation for constitutional rights in Ontario.
Well, that has certainly been the practice in the province of Quebec, where they've used it many times over the years. And the conventional wisdom in Ontario always used to be no government will ever use this clause because the political price to be paid for doing so would be too high. Maybe we've been wrong about that. Maybe there will not be a price to be paid. Are you concerned about that?
Well, I'm hoping there's a price to be paid. I'm hoping at the next election on June 2nd of 2022, when people are about to put in their ballot, that they remember what this premier did. In other words, in order to muzzle his political enemies, he decided to use the notwithstanding clause. And I hope they find it very reminiscent of what is going on in the United States with the Republican Party, who are acting in similar ways to muzzle the speech or the votes of who they view to be their political enemies.
All right, Paul, in which case, let's finish up and really discover where the rubber hits the road here. How, in your view, are your clients, working families and others who would want to take out advertising around an election campaign and on the subject of how well the government of the day is doing, how do you think that those efforts will be disadvantaged by putting into effect what are, in effect, the old rules?
Well, the problem is that we had a great deal of evidence indicated that, first of all, 12 months is a ridiculously long period. When you have an election in June of 2022, people do not turn their minds to the election until, certainly sometime after the new year. So 12 months is ridiculous. The other thing is the amount of money that they can spend is not sufficient to mount an effective campaign. So they're really hobbled. When at the same time, as I said before, the government has an unlimited advertising budget to spend money on advertising, and the political parties have huge amount of money to spend, far more than third parties. So what is happening here is that the political parties and the government are drowning out third parties. And of course, the concern has always been that third parties will drown out political parties. Well, the opposite effect has occurred. And many people are concerned about that because they don't believe that the political process belongs to the government and the political parties. They feel that the independent parties are very useful. They bring forward issues that the political parties or governments don't. They add different perspectives to issues and positions taken by the political parties and government, so that there is a real useful need for independent third parties in the political discourse. And unfortunately, this bill is attempting to drown them out.
And again, just finally, just so we understand the harm that you believe this will do to your clients, let's put it on a sliding scale. Let's assume zero means no harm at all. 10 means, cataclysmic, metaphysical, apocalyptic harm that your clients will suffer. Where do you think it is on that scale of 0 to 10?
About 9.
No kidding, that high?
Yeah, yeah. Hmm. And that's why we're seriously looking at legally challenging this legislation that I guess is about to pass today or tomorrow.
Exactly right. As we sit here on a Monday afternoon, it should be in place by later tonight. So Paul Cavalluzzo, thanks a lot for joining us on the On Poly podcast today.
Okay, you're welcome, Stephen. Good to talk to you.
Pleasure was ours. We always conclude this podcast with our favorite quotes of the week, and we'll have that for you immediately after we ask you to give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. We always like to know what you think, what you like, what you don't like, and help make this little podcast just a little bit better.
You can also shoot us an email at onpolitics@tvo.org.
Here now is my quote of the week, and it's Liberal leader Stephen Del Duca saying, when Doug Ford was urged to pass a law offering sick days to employees so they wouldn't bring COVID-19 into the workplace, it took him 400 days to do so. However, and here comes the Liberal leader.
When it comes to protecting his own political skin, when it comes to his re-election campaign, Doug Ford found, I guess, the capacity to move at lightning speed and in 24 hours come up with a plan to invoke the notwithstanding clause. I think it's reckless because it's treating our Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which is something that Canadians, Ontarians hold dear and value, as we should. It treats it like a political doormat.
That's Liberal leader Stephen Del Duca on the government's use of the notwithstanding clause of the Charter in order to reinstate the election expenses law the government preferred.
And my quote of the week comes from Health Minister Christine Elliott. This is from Monday morning. She was asked if Ontario is considering any kind of financial incentives to boost the uptake of COVID-19 vaccines. We've seen the use of lotteries, for example, in other provinces and some U.S. states. And, you know, this is a concern right now because of the increased spread and severity of new COVID variants. Some doctors are saying that if we can't get our vaccine numbers up to like 90% of people over 12, we may never reach herd immunity. And here is what the health minister said about that on Monday.
No, we're not, because we are seeing that people are coming forward quite willingly to receive their shots. We already have over 74% of the adult population has received their first dose, and we are well on our way to having 20% of the population vaccinated in order to move us into step two of our reopening plan. So we're very grateful to the people of Ontario for being so willing to receive their shots.
That's Health Minister and Deputy Premier Christine Elliott speaking at Queen's Park on Monday.
And that was episode 116 of the On Poly podcast, produced by Katie O'Connor, editing with Matthew O'Mara, our production support coordinators, Nikki Ashworth and Jonathan Hallowell. JMM, how do I always like to tag this broadcast?
Stay positive, test negative.
That sounds like a good line. Why don't we go with that? As my dad likes to say, JMM, stay positive, test negative.
Stay safe, Steve.